Hi, Undisclosed listeners. Now, I know you probably have heard the news that there is an exciting new documentary series that will be premiering on HBO starting Sunday, March 10th. The series will run for 4 consecutive Sundays, and it's called The Case Against Adnan Syed. Now, as you guys know, Undisclosed got its start by covering the Adnan Syed case, and we've kept on top of it all these years, and we're going to continue to do so. We've been on a little bit of a hiatus, but we're going to start off 2019 with a whole new season, a mini season, that tracks the new documentary series starting the week of March 10th. So make sure you subscribe, tune in, don't miss out. These will be new episodes all about the new documentary series, The Case Against Adnan Syed. Don't miss the new documentary series and don't miss our new mini season covering it.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm here today with two of the attorneys for Charles Ray Finch. They're both from Duke. Jamie Lau, you might recognize from the Ronnie Long series that we did. And Jim Coleman is the attorney currently handling the federal appeals. And so welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
Yeah, so this is an old case. We have to go all the way back to February 13th, 1976, and we have this incident at a country store in eastern North Carolina. And so what can you tell me about that incident?
Well, the owner of the store and gas station was about to close up at 9 o'clock, and his employee and he were standing outside as he was putting on the lock. And three African-American men walked up to them. One of them stayed back. Two of them came up to the door and asked if he would reopen the store so that he could get an Alka-Seltzer. And the owner agreed to do that. As he was standing outside, he had openly displayed a handgun. He reopened the door, and he walked into the store on one side of a counter, and his employee, a guy by the name of Jones, walked in behind him, but on the other side of the counter, and then two of the black men walked in single file, after Jones on the same side of the counter as Jones. When they got to the back of the store and the lights were off, the only light in the store was a beer sign advertisement that had a lighted clock dial. When they got to the back of the store, the owner, a Mr. Holloman, took out an Alka-Seltzer and then turned around and asked the man who had requested it if he would like water. And according to Jones, the other black man said to him, and your money too, and pulled out a shotgun. At that point, the two men exchanged fire, and Jones hit the floor, scrambling away, because apparently people were shooting at him, too. And then they left the store. When it was over, Mr. Holloman had been fatally wounded, and Jones called for medical assistance and also called the Highway Patrol.
Right. And so the next day, which is now Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1976, we have Charles Ray Finch and another man who are arrested, and they're putting these various lineups for Jones to identify. And so what can you tell us about the nature of those lineups and what they were wearing?
Let me tell you, before that, when the Highway Patrol showed up at the scene shortly after 9 p.m., they interviewed Jones, and he gave them a written statement, handwritten by him, that indicated in a very summary fashion what had happened and described the two men. Actually described only one of them by what he was wearing, the clothes, and then said about the second man who allegedly had the shotgun that he had a stocking over his head. When the deputy, a guy by the name of Tony Owens, deputy sheriff, showed up, he began to question people on the scene about whether they had seen Charles Ray Finch. He had not talked to Jones, so he initiated any discussion about Finch. When Noble Harris, who was just an onlooker, said that he had seen Finch, he thought he had seen Finch earlier that day, Owens called to other deputies and to the Wilson Police Department and asked them to pick up Finch, who would be driving in his blue Cadillac. And they picked up Finch and with another person, Charles Lewis, who was in his car at the time, took them down to the sheriff's department, and then they put them in a lineup. And then they showed Jones the lineup, and he was asked if he could identify any of the people who were involved in the attempted robbery and the murder. And he allegedly identified Charles Ray Finch. In the lineup, Charles Ray Finch is the only person wearing a coat, and he's wearing a three-quarter-length leather jacket, and he's put in position five in the lineup. The significance of that, we have come to believe, is that when Jones initially goes, after he sees the first lineup, he's asked if he recognized any of the perpetrators. And he said the person who was in position number four. He then, according to him, he then corrected that and said, no, it's number five. And number four would have been a different person, one of the fillers. Number five in the first lineup was Charles Ray Finch. So they brought him back and they set up a second lineup. And this time they put Charles Ray Finch in the number four position. And again, he was wearing a coat. And Jones goes out and he comes back and he identifies one of the perpetrators as the man who was in position number four, Charles Ray Finch. And then they show him a third lineup, and Charles Ray Finch is in the second position, and he identifies him again as the one of the perpetrators.
Right. And as you noted, in addition to his eyewitness identification, we have this man who says that he sees Charles Ray Finch by the country store, and that's Noble Harris. And so at least back in 1976... what is Harris saying about seeing Finch?
Harris can't say what time it was, but when he testifies, he says that it was on the edge of darkness. It had not yet gotten fully dark. When on cross-examination, the defense lawyer pressed him for a time, and apparently what has happened is that when the defense lawyer interviewed him in June for the trial, he must have interviewed him at night around 8 o'clock, and Noble Harris told him that at the time in February, it was on the edge of darkness, and we believe that he indicated that it was about the same conditions as it had been at around 8 o'clock in June of 1976, when Noble Harris testified. He made it clear that although he wasn't certain about the time, he was certain that it had not yet gotten fully dark. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when we looked up the what the conditions would have been in February of 1976, it would have been on the edge of dark at around 6 o'clock, 9 o'clock at the time that the crime had occurred.
And so there's no physical evidence that's linking Finch to the crime. It's largely based upon this testimony by Jones and Harris, but in 1976, Finch is convicted, and he's been in prison ever since, and he's filed a number of appeals. The most recent state appeal ended around 2015, and it claimed things such as ineffective assistance of counsel and Brady violations. And so what were some of the claims that were made there in state court around 2015?
Well, the state court proceedings, after an investigation, once the case had came to the project, what was learned was a couple things. The first thing that was learned was that the victim had, in fact, been killed by a pistol and not a shotgun. A shotgun blast would spray buckshot pellets into the victim, and he only had a single wound entering into his neck and a single slug removed. The medical examiner conceded that it should have been deemed a pistol and not a shotgun wound, and that was the first bit of evidence that began to undermine the eyewitness identification that was made by Jones, who was working in the store that night, because he was unequivocal in his testimony and as well as his statements that he had been in a gun fight or a shootout with an individual with a shotgun as opposed to an individual with a pistol, and there's obviously a significant difference. The other thing that we learned related to that was when Ray was picked up in his car, there was a shotgun shell that was in his car that his son had said was in the car when it was bought by Ray. But at the time of trial, they cut open that shotgun shell and they passed it around to the jurors. And then they took the projectile that had been taken from Mr. Holloman's wound and they passed that around, and they, in essence, allowed the jurors to make a lay comparison between the two and to determine that, yeah, it was probably a similar shotgun shell that was loaded into the shotgun during the shootout that resulted in the death of Mr. Holloman. The problem was, during the course of our investigation, we learned the fact that the projectile that was removed had been sent to the State Bureau of Investigation's lab. It was not disclosed, but they were unable to say that it came from a shotgun shell like the one in the car. So what was ultimately done was the jury's lay comparison was allowed to usurp the comparison made by the forensic lab that had the experience in making such comparisons, and that was never turned over to Ray at the time that he was tried. So that was a significant piece of evidence. And then the last thing that was really telling was there had been some questions during the post-conviction review of just how those lineups had been conducted, and the lead investigator in the case, Deputy Owings, had given false statements related to how the lineups were conducted, and we were able to show that his testimony about how those lineups were conducted during the course of the evidentiary hearing were false because they weren't in fact conducted as he described. He has repeatedly said that during each of the three lineups, the individuals presented in those lineups were forced to change clothes. The jacket was moved to different individuals in those lineups so as to ensure that the person being selected was being selected on the basis of their facial characteristics, not any anything that distinguished their appearance. But what ultimately was the case was that was all fabricated in each lineup. All the people in the three lineups are wearing the exact same article, the clothing, and the jacket remains on Ray Finch during each of the three lineups. So that was an entirely false depiction of how those lineups were conducted.
Right. And so we have this various evidence related to the ballistics and the weapon used. We have the issues with the eyewitness identification procedure. But ultimately, what do the state courts in North Carolina rule?
They deny our post-conviction motion in its entirety. They find that the identification was suggestive. However, they found that the in-court identification was independent and sufficient to support the conviction. They deny each of the other claims that we raised. And then the appellate courts in North Carolina, when the petition for certiorari were filed, they have discretionary review, and they opted not to review the findings of the state post-conviction court And that ultimately led us to federal court, where Jim Coleman picked up the litigation and really carried the torch through the federal court proceeding.
Right. And so you take the case up to federal district court in North Carolina, and why do they rule against you?
We lost on a procedural ground, which is that under the federal statute, a petition for writ of habeas corpus has to be filed within a year of the time that the petitioner discovered the evidence on which his claims rely. And in our case, the evidence on which we based our claims, all of it, well, not all of it, but most of it had been discovered more than a year before we filed our federal claim. We knew that going in, so we also asked for relief from the statute of limitation on the ground that we believe the evidence showed that Ray was actually innocent, which is the standard, the federal standard, that would allow the federal district court to review all of Ray's claims on the merits, notwithstanding any procedural defaults or notwithstanding that the statute of limitation had run. So we lost on procedural grounds. And in addition, the court denied what's called a certificate of appealability, which means that the court did not think that we had raised an issue that presented a colorable claim, and so it would not have given us the right to appeal to the Fourth Circuit.
Right.
So as a result of that, we were forced to ask the Fourth Circuit to grant the certificate of appealability. And it sat on the case for about a year, and then after a year, it certified one question for appeal, which was whether we could demonstrate by preponderance of the evidence that Ray was actually innocent.
Right. And then the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, this recent opinion that has come down, they do. They find that Finch has established actual innocence, and they do so both by looking at issues related to Harris as well as issues related to Jones. And so what do they find about Jones and the eyewitness identification in this case?
Well, first of all, they agreed that the lineups were suggestive in violation of the Constitution, that Jones's identification of Ray was not reliable, and among other reasons, because he claimed that he was standing 2 feet from the man who killed Holloman with a shotgun, and the evidence demonstrated conclusively that the man had been killed with a handgun, not a shotgun, and the court thought that that undermined Jones's credibility. In addition, Jones was unable to describe the face of the man who allegedly was Ray Finch. At the time, we had photographs showing that Ray had a beard and mustache, and Jones at no time was able to describe the perpetrator as having had a beard or a mustache. And so the court thought that a reasonable juror would not have found his identification credible.
Right. And then with regard to Harris, again, the person who testified about seeing Finch outside this country store, and we have some questions about the timing, what were the developments with him and what he had to say after 1976 that the court relies upon?
When Owens first interviewed Harris, 2 days later, he went out to his home and he asked him if he had seen Ray inside the store that night. And Harris told him that he had not, and that although he thought the man he saw was Ray, he didn't know for sure that it was Ray. He said that Owens then drove away, telling him that that was not helpful for him. And then before Jones testified at trial, the prosecutor and Owens brought him back into a lawyer's room, and they asked him if he would testify that he saw Ray inside the store. And he told him that he would not because he didn't see him inside the store. And they told him that Jones was prepared to testify that Harris was inside the store when Ray Finch was inside the store that night. And Harris told them that if he testified to that, that is, if Jones testified to that, he would be testifying to a lie. So there was evidence that the prosecutor and the deputy were trying to get Noble Harris to perjure himself in the trial.
Right. And so then breaking that all down, the Fourth Circuit says you have huge issues with your two key witnesses, both with the witnesses themselves as well as government misconduct connected to them. And so they find Finch has met this actual innocence standard. And you touched upon this a bit before. We would think, you know, in common usage, he's actually innocent. He's going to be released. But in fact, all this means is what?
All it means now is that he is entitled to have the federal district court consider all of his constitutional claims on the merits without regard to either a procedural default or without regard to the one-year statute of limitation.
Right. So possibly in a year, 2 years, 3 years, he might have his conviction thrown out. He might be released. Or despite the finding of actual innocence, he might not get relief, right?
Well, if the litigation continued, those two things are possible. That it could go on for a year or more, both in the district court, and then there would be an appeal to the Fourth Circuit if we lost. And it's possible that on some other ground, the federal district court might find, based on the findings in state court, that Ray is not entitled to relief on the merits of his claim.
Right. And so here we are. Mr. Finch is 80 years old. We're recording today on February 12th, 2019, so it's one day short of 43 years since this crime occurred. And yeah, we might be a few years out from relief or no relief at all. And so you and your team are trying to expedite this process. So what are your efforts to get him released before having to rely on the courts, and how can our listeners help in those efforts?
Right. Well, the Fourth Circuit was correct in finding that Ray is actually innocent. And one of the things that has distinguished the law enforcement officials in North Carolina's approach to this case from the very beginning is that they have never addressed the merits of Ray's claim of innocence. That is, they have never looked at the facts and told us that they believe that there are facts that would support the conclusion that Ray is guilty. By the time we reached federal court, we had basically destroyed all of the evidence on which they relied. They went from claiming that Ray had been the actual killer to now claiming only that he was at the scene. And that the basis for finding him guilty is not because he killed the victim, but because he was present when some unknown person killed the victim. So we're going to the Attorney General, and we are asking him to concede what is true, which is that there is no evidence whatever that Ray was involved in this crime, that there's never been any evidence that he was involved in this crime, and that he is entitled to be released from prison and the convictions overturned and the charges against him dismissed. And that should happen without us having to litigate a moment further in this case.
Right. And another possible route for relief here is that the governor of North Carolina could issue a pardon, right? And the family of Charles Ray Finch on change.org, the hyperlink's too long to read, we'll post it on the show notes, but they are asking for people to sign on to a petition that asks the governor of North Carolina, Roy Cooper, to issue a pardon, which would then lead to his immediate release, right?
That's correct. And to the extent that your listeners can go sign that to show their support for Ray, the family and everybody working to secure his release would be grateful.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Any final thoughts that you have before we close?
Yeah, let me just add one other fact that I think we've not discussed, which is that the Fourth Circuit, and interestingly, the North Carolina Supreme Court also in 1978, noted that Ray had several alibi witnesses who testified in detail that on the night that this crime occurred, Ray was playing cards with friends at a shoeshine parlor in downtown Wilson. The North Carolina Supreme Court noted that they testified in detail to those facts, and the Fourth Circuit said that a jury hearing all of the evidence also would likely believe the alibi witnesses.
Do we know Mr. Finch is African-American? Do we know the racial composition of the jurors and the races of the alibi witnesses?
We think that the jury was 11 white and one African-American retired teacher. The witnesses, Noble Harris is African-American. All of the alibi witnesses were African-American. Jones was white, and the deputy, Tony Owens, is white.
All right, great. Well, thank you so much, Jamie and Jim, for talking with me today again. And listeners, again, the best way you can help is to go to change.org and sign the petition to Governor Roy Cooper asking for a pardon of Charles Ray Finch.
Thank you for having us, Colin.
I'd like to thank the following people. Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Mital Telhan, our executive producer. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @undisclosedpod.